Welcome to The Art of Construction, the podcast dedicated to helping you grow your business. Together, we'll explore the world of construction with some of the best minds of the industry. Your host, Evan Tilley, a micro-influencer and sometimes disruptor, will take you on a journey that will lead your business to the next level.
What's up, Art of Construction Tribe? Devin Tilley here, and this intro is so fun for me. I'm going to weave through some different stories as we're going to come together, and this podcast is going to be the live Digital Built Week recording from 2022 in Anaheim, where we did a bunch of different podcasts, and the ones I love are those live ones putting together. And this is moving forward from when the back in 2019, when I recorded Steve Burrows on stage. And massive shout out to Digital Built Week and allowing us to come in and capture these live conversations and weave them together into these global and timeless fireside chats and these panels of different podcasts coming together. So I had Steve Burrows, which was AOC's show 153, which is one of our best podcasts and highest rating show 153 titled, "This is the greatest time in history to be in construction," recorded live. And that was when that one was in the morning, and they brought a bottle of bourbon, scotch-ish, and they brought a bottle to the stage early in the morning. But this one this year was at the end of the day. And I'm super excited to keep this conversation going. So this year's live podcast was with a whole panel. And so we had Alice Leung, who we also talked with on show 266, Funding the Innovators. And she talked about that part of it, of funding the innovators. And one of those innovators that was on the panel was Moritz Luck, who founded and recently sold Enscape. And it goes back to show 157, titled How a Video Game Became Architect's Most Powerful New Tool. And lastly, Phil Reed, who here is another trifecta, his third time on the Art of Construction podcast, where recently we just released show 273 titled Managing Technology and Managing People, which he and I recorded in between at the conference, as well as back to show 137 titled Don't Go to College to Become an Architect, another one of our top-rated shows. So all these top-rated shows coming together, this is a panel where I ask the questions and we have a great conversation, so many lessons learned. So without further ado, let's jump into this live panel with Alice Leung, Moritz Luck, Phil Reed, moderated by yours truly, the leader of the Art of Construction Tribe, Devin Tilley. Lock and load, let's have some fun. Alice, what kinds of leadership companies, technologies are desirable to an investment partner?
Thanks for that question. it's always a challenge for me to answer this one because I have my personal opinion and then I have the investor's opinion. So if I was investing in companies, right, you know, my biggest rule is the no asshole rule. We don't want to work with assholes. We're going to, you know, if we're investing in a company, we are going to be working with them for probably more than 7 years, which is longer than a marriage in the US at least. So yeah, it's a long-term relationship. You're gonna be on the board. You're gonna be working with these founders and entrepreneurs for a long time. You wanna make sure that you guys get along, right? So the first thing is a no asshole rule. And on the investing side, we really look at how the entrepreneurs execute. So we do look at them over a period of time. We're never gonna just, you know, take one pitch and invest, right? There's a lot of entrepreneurs who can tell really great stories. There's a lot of entrepreneurs who have incredible charisma, but look at how that's worked out for WeWork and Katerra, and there's a lot of those that we can get into. But just because, you know, an entrepreneur has charisma and can tell a great story doesn't mean that they can actually build a company. So we do look at execution a lot, being able to work with customers, get all of that feedback from your customers and iterate that back into your product to make sure that you're building the right thing for the industry. And I would also say I don't know if modesty is the right word, but just self-awareness of the entrepreneurs to know what their strengths and weaknesses are and to hire people around them that kind of fills in all those gaps and just making sure that, you know, they are surrounding themselves with people that all kind of support each other and push the company upwards. So those are all the things that we would look at from an investment side. I think personally, I would also just look at, you know, it's this energy. I don't know how to explain it, but, you know, you've probably met people and talked to people where you just feel this great energy and you just want to be around those people. I realized that, you know, people gravitate towards others, and maybe this is more on, you know, teamwork and collaboration, but that's something that I personally look for, even though it's not kind of this quantifiable thing on the investment side that we can look for. But the number one rule is the no asshole rule.
Totally agree with that. So Moritz, so since the title of this conversation is investment strategies, and I know you're into that, right? How much money did you need, and where do you invest it, like when you got going with Enscape?
Thanks, yeah, that's a very good question. So we got lucky because we didn't need all that much money. We got an advice early on from another startup who said it's like drinking salt water if you get an investment. So you always get thirstier. The more you drink, the thirstier you get. And so we got that after our first investment from a couple of business angels. So we had family and friends investing in the company. And then we had some business angel and one VC. And that was it. So in total, because we split the company, it was around 600,000 euros. And then we split the company. So half of that went into Enscape, basically. And so that was all that we needed to get it going. And yeah, we did run very lean at first. So when we started before, I think right up to the moment when we started selling Enscape, the team wasn't much larger than five, six people. And basically all of them engineers. And only then did we scale into support and all the other functions that you need when you bring a product to market. But yeah, early on, we did run very lean and we're very cost effective. And I think that's also part of the success of Enscape. We did that until the very end. So I think, yeah, to the size of the revenues and all that, the team was rather small because we did automate as much as we could. And so we were very strong in the techie space, but yeah, we didn't scale much in the other space.
And the part that I've learned from Moritz, he's always talking about the customer. What can I learn from the customer and be more focused to the customer? And that I think is very important as we're all sitting here trying to, how can we best help our customers, right? And live right in front of us, that's what you've done and how you Enscape came out, and it was like, just blew by everybody. Like the podcast with Ellen talked about how they've grown 100 people through COVID, which is just amazing, right? So Phil, what companies have you invested in, and talk about why?
Okay, so I'll untangle this by starting at the end. Over the last 20 years, I know the Venn diagrams of the companies I've invested in have certain characteristics. And there's reasons as I look back on why I've invested in them and why I think they've done well. But you know, as always, past performance is not indicative of future results. Apple, Autodesk, Adobe, Alphabet, and which is Google, and NVIDIA. Those are the companies that I've always come back to, and there's been other ones around it, but those ones have been a pretty solid part of the portfolio.
So Alice, when is the right time to look for an investment partner now that we've kind of teed this up and talked about getting started and growing with what Moritz has done, starting with a few people, to now saying, yeah, that's what Brick and Mortar Ventures does?
Yeah, so I'm going to speak on this for venture funding, which is very different from private equity, which could, you know, private equity is kind of a more general version, and venture capital falls under that. And then, of course, there's, you know, grants, there's all different types of funding mechanisms that you can go after. But I'm going to talk about venture capital. So for venture capital, usually the best time for a VC to get in is right before that hockey stick growth, right? So your company's revenues may be chugging along, right? But something will change. There is some type of inflection point, whether it's nailing go-to-market strategy or, you know, for instance, maybe sustainability, some government regulation or some type of change in the market somewhere that is going to cause this hockey stick growth. So you're going from, you know, almost stagnant growth up to this exponential growth curve. And for the venture capital firms, they want to invest right before that hockey stick growth. Because what that means is we get to buy into a company when their valuations are still low. But right after we invest, those companies are going to shoot up in valuation because their revenues are going to grow and they're onto something and they're able to grow and scale as fast as possible. And it'll just kind of shoot up in valuation and then we'll make, you know, hundreds of X in return multiples. So that's the goal, right? So venture capitalists, they are investing to make as much money as possible. So we are investing at that inflection point, at least on the early stage. For later stage venture capital firms, they may have different multiple profiles. They may say, I'm perfectly fine with a 2x multiple. So I'm going to look for a company that is doing well. They've got a business plan that's figured out. They're a well-oiled machine and they are predictable. And I know that over the next 3 years, they're going to have X revenue and they're going to be valued at X. And I'm going to make that investment. So the rule of thumb here is the earlier that you invest, the riskier it is because you have less data and there just isn't that much history to invest based on. So brick and mortar ventures, we sit in seed and series A. Some could argue that's generally the riskiest from an institutional investor perspective. And it's typically the first round of funding after the friends and family and the angel rounds.
There also is pre-seed.
There's pre-seed, but a lot of the times for pre-seed investors, when you write a check, you don't actually value the company with that check. You might just say, I'm going to give you $500K and I think it may be worth this much, but I don't know. So I'm going to put a cap saying, you know, maybe you'll max be worth $10 million when I write this check. So it's not valued per se, but for when we get involved with the round, we will say, we think this company is valued at X number of dollars, and we are taking a certain percentage of that company valued at X number of dollars.
Yeah, and I love that. And we're always talking about how to grow your business. And Moritz, as you talked about at the beginning, the seed, a little bit of money, a few people. Can you talk with us about, from your perception, what is the right or wrong early employee, and how do you tactically pick those right people to help you get the business going?
That's a very good question. I mean, the no asshole rule is pretty good, but then I recently read a book which I found quite good, where there may be assholes that are worthwhile having if they are driven and if they're purpose driven. But typically, we didn't employ these. So we rather looked at. And we had some great people working with us early on. And early on, what you want in someone, because you have very few people on the team, so you need generalists who are able to do a lot of tasks and are fairly good at all of them and can dig into a topic and teach and educate themselves, because everyone is very busy doing all kinds of stuff. There's fires everywhere that you need to put out. And so you need people that are very capable in many tasks. And we had some, when we first employed some people, we got lucky that actually Thomas and I discussed it while we were on vacation together. We just discussed this topic of who were the people who added to the success of Enscape early on. And we came to the conclusion that, we did have some great people on the team. And so the question is now, how do you select them? And maybe it's also a kind of self-selection, because early on it's not as easy to add great talent, but maybe there are people who just want to come into a startup in this early phase, and because it's also more for their personality. They want more freedom. You get more freedom. You can work more on your own and by yourself, and you're not compressed into one role as you would be in a larger company. And there are people who are working better in that kind of environment. And so these are the people that you want, and maybe these are the people that are also go looking for a job like that, deliberately or maybe by accident, but who end up in a company like that. And yeah, so we got quite lucky. And what I think worked well is having people that were passionate about what we did. People who saw what we did, who understood the vision, And then we're passionate about this vision also. And because they either experienced the pain of what we solved. So as you said before, you want to help some customer easing some pain that they experience. So, and help them with a problem that they have. And so either if you have someone who has experienced this pain, this is why Phil came up to us and why he wanted to work with us, if I remember correctly. Because you said that during your studies, you would have wished to have such a tool. And so this is awesome. If you have someone who really experienced this problem and then says, oh, this is exactly the solution that I was looking for, and having these people, they give more energy to it because they know how the company can help other people. And these are the people that you should be looking for early on, because that's also helping with the culture of the company. And then you're less political, which is something that you don't want to have. But everyone's driven by the purpose of the company and how can we make customers succeed. And I think this is the culture that you want in your company early on, and also later. I mean, it's just maybe the foundation is laid in the very beginning.
Yeah, we talk a lot on the podcast about the riches and the niches, but you kind of got to start with the generalists, right? And so, Ellen, after our podcast yesterday, we talked about how one of my big takeaways from the conference is the power of no. And you have to go to different elements to help people coach you to do that. And Steve and Ellen did this great presentation and got to there. And one of the questions was, well, what do you do if they don't know anything about Revit? And they're like, we don't hire them. I was like, that is how you set the rules of the game, right? Or figure that out, of the generalists to the specialists. As Ellen was talking about how, well, I did all this and now other people are taking over these roles and they're challenging and doing it much better. And that's that growth. So the hockey stick, I think, Alice, that you're talking about is you first got to be able to stay alive and have people that can help you with that. And then as you scale that, then you figure that stuff out.
Exactly. That's when you bring in people who know a lot more about the subject than you do, who are very specialized in one field. And they are very happy to fill in this role. And yeah.
So the next question for Phil is around when you're getting going around, remember the podcast that is kind of controversial, but very in a good way. You know, Phil, what are the worst investments as a recent college grad?
Okay. Yeah. So these are some questions that Dev and I told up. I'll give you a little background. It's when I think about investing in, it's, you know, you're investing your time, you're investing your money. It's not the purpose of investing is not about making money. It's about giving you other opportunities. Okay. So,
Ellis, would you agree?
She gets the question
next. No. I would say this. Yeah. It's, we can disagree. It's okay. It's not about just making money. I think you also have to, in your career and in your life, or maybe I'll just speak for myself. I've had jobs where I've made a lot of money and I hated it and it was soul crushing, and I would wake up multiple times at night and think, why are you doing this? You're gonna die one day and hate what you've done. And then you have to have this balance between money and meaning. And the money is a recognition of your effort and of your expertise and of your opinions and of your experience. But if you just get the money and you don't have time to enjoy it as a good meal with friends, or you go on vacation and you can't decouple from that job because you hate it, and you know in 2 weeks you have to go back, then that's not fun. So I think what we have to do is find the right balance. And early in the career, you know, we might try to sacrifice one for the other, and it's a tough choice. And particularly when you're younger, I use silly metaphors. I think dollars are seeds, and we're planting them all the time, and you want to plant them well. Like, what do you do with a dollar? So it's when you're young, I would ask you guys to do things like in architecture school, I wish they would teach you Excel from the first semester. Because Excel is actually the design tool that everything starts with. You have to do these things called feasibility studies. And it might not be an interesting design problem, but here's your budget. Here's an existing house. And you have to design a kitchen for that house on time and on budget. But you're going to do it with Excel as well. Like, because it builds constraints, and constraints create constraints actually force you to become creative. If you have, before you decide what you're going to cook for dinner, you have to look in the fridge Then you go, oh, okay, well, I've got this, this, and this. Now I know I can have for dinner. There's your choice. But at architecture school, they just say, oh, you know, it doesn't matter. Just come up with a bunch of ideas. But they don't have constraints. And so I think that creates a lot of wasted time. So when you guys, you know, now that you're coming out of school, I think you would really do well to make some early, you would plant seeds now that can grow into really useful things. So I think the worst thing a student can do first off is just borrow a bunch of money that's an unrecoverable debt to go to school. If you're borrowing $50,000, $60,000 a year to go to school and you graduate, that's probably $2,000 a month in interest for the rest of your life. That's an unrecoverable debt. The reason I said to Devin, you guys can go listen to it, is don't go to college to become an architect, is because it's too expensive in terms of time and experience and money. You should go to college. I would encourage someone who's in high school to go to technical school and get a 2-year, 1.5-year degree in architectural technology and learn how to solve problems. You learn how to use your tools, and that's kind of pejorative in the architectural world. They like to talk about philosophy and ideas, and you make blobs instead of decisions. Learn to use the tool. And then go to college and study something else. It could be completely unrelated to architecture, but that's going to make you more interesting. And then go to work for a company like Turner Fleischer. You've got 18 months, 2 years in architectural technology. They're going to welcome you in that door. You're not going to be a great designer, but that's okay because they have a room full of great designers, and it's nice when you don't have to learn that after 5 years of architecture school. You go in and start learning to solve problems. And you're going to college as well, which means you have enough time to drink, but not too much time to drink because you have to be at work. Now you've worked at Turner Fleischer for 5 years or 4 years, getting experience with a background in architecture technology, and you're going to go and get your master's degree in something called architecture. Now you have experience, you can solve problems. You haven't spent 7 years in a time sink borrowing $50,000, $60,000 a year. And Ellen's going to beg you to stay because you're going to be a very attractive employee to a lot of other competitors. You're in a very good position. I hate to tell you this now, if you're a young graduate, you're only worth what it costs to replace you in terms of business. Right? How much should you get paid? You will not get paid, with very little exception, more than the cost of replacement. So if you get another job offer, then they're probably going to say, well, okay, thanks. Go work with my competition and gum up their works. Or they'll say, well, you know, that's what the market will bear. Please stay. But you can't get more than the market will bear. You can't get more than what it costs to replace you. So the worst things that you could do as a recent graduate is waste your time, waste your money, and make poor health decisions. Generally. Specifically, the worst things that you can do are watch TV, buy $4 coffees, and drink too much, eat too much, eat processed foods. Those kinds of decisions will empty, those decisions alone early on will empty your bank account. Buy a new car, that's a terrible decision. You should buy the cheapest, shittiest used car that you can afford. Get a good bike, but don't buy a new car. Those are unrecoverable business decisions. And so I would start with that. Like, don't buy $4 coffees. I see all you guys with $4 coffees. I'll buy a $4 coffee on the condition I can expense it, but I can't afford a $4 coffee otherwise. Yeah.
Well, there you have it, right?
Coffees are $6 now.
$6? I don't know. I have a $100 Amazon, bought on Amazon. It's a 20-bar espresso machine. It's like makes the best coffee ever. And then when you buy a $6 coffee, you're like, oh, why did I buy this? It's so disappointing.
You just bought $6 coffee?
Yes, because I needed it because of the jet lag.
So I would buy $4 coffee if it was an investment. And in terms of I have jet lag and I'm tired, now I can buy $4 coffee because it's a tool, not a toy. Or I would buy $4 coffee if I could have a conversation with someone who's going to teach me something, or learn something. That's an investment. If you buy food and you can expense it, that's like an amazing fit. So take someone older than you to breakfast once a month, let them mentor you, and then expense it. And they'll be, oh, no, I should pay. They will insist on paying. Go, no, I've just learned something. Or you can pay $100 to somebody, pay $200 an hour to a psychologist in 50 years, or you could pay $30 for breakfast to someone who's two generations older and learn something.
So do you recommend buying a new version every year?
Every year, as an investment, as a tool, not a toy. Yeah, we're lifting up iPhones. So.
I'll add to that.
Oh, Jesus.
Totally,
it's Ellen. I'm afraid now.
I agree with you. Don't be scared. Work for a few years, and then
There.
Yeah, so Ellen in the crowd for the podcast just talked back about how come and add value, know how to use Revit or whatever the rules of the game are, then we're going to reinvest together and all win together versus be in debt, right?
Yeah.
Alice, what kind of investment terms are parasitic or adversarial to the technology startup of all these people that are trying to figure all that out?
Yes, so a lot of startups ask me, like, you know, should I do this accelerator program? Should I take money from this corporate venture capital group? Should I take strategic investment? Should I do XYZ? Should I sell my company? Should I do, you know, whatever? Should I sell part of my company? Should I just take these grants? It's always a decision based on negotiation, right? And I think one very important thing to note is everything is a negotiation when it comes to private investing, not public investing, but private investing. Everything is a negotiation. Every term sheet can be negotiated. People will try to throw in as much as possible. Leverage your lawyers. And if you are a startup that doesn't have a lot of money, good legal counsel is worth the money. They are there to protect you from these parasitic terms. So parasitic terms could be, you know, if I make an investment in your company, you are exclusive to me and you have to build what I tell you to build. And we've seen a lot of these types of terms out there for startups that, you know, may be cash strapped or they may be in a situation where it's like, I need to make payroll and I need this money. And you go talk to people and that's when you can get taken advantage of, right? Because you're in this situation. So you get a pre-planning to have those conversations with your investors, whatever type of investor you are, or whatever type of investor that you want to get out there, have enough time to do that negotiation, and then look at those terms that may limit your growth potential. So we don't want any exclusivity. We also don't want you giving away too much of your company, depending on, you know, who you're raising capital from. There might be some terms around information rights. So if you are, say, a company that is doing something that might be competing with an existing Autodesk product, and if Autodesk comes in and wants to be an investor, or even any of their competitors, say Bentley, whoever it is out there, they may say, if I invest in your company, you need to give me information. And the information about your product roadmap may inform them to go build a competing software. And we've seen things like these where large companies are playing nice with the startups, but at the end of the day, they either want to crush you or they want to just build exactly what you are building. So just getting the legal counsel, reading through all these terms, and trying to look for things that limit your growth.
Great stuff. So Moritz, as you have just passed the baton, Enscape's founding it to selling it, can you talk about a couple of the top lessons learned through that process?
Well, there's many, many lessons learned throughout this process. I don't remember what I should answer. One important thing is listen to the customer. Do what the customer really needs. I think that's one of the biggest lessons, next to all the others. Like, how do you lead a team and how do you grow a team? How do you talk to investors? Better not bring them on, and it's liberating. I mean, we have a VC here, but it's very liberating if you are profitable and you don't have to rely on them. But that's only possible if you have a customer and the customer buy your product. And so this is why it's so important for you to make the customer happy, because then you can live off them. If they are happy, then they're happy to pay for you, and then you don't need as much VC money. And that was very liberating for us. And when we hit this moment, after not too long a period, early days, that we got profitable, that was very good. And then, as Alice was saying, people, also investors, want to force you in one direction or the other. When you're profitable, you don't have to listen. You can just do what's best for the company. And since you are closest to the customer, you're closest to your business, a lot of times you know better. it's always good to have good investors and to listen to them and to hear their opinion. But if you don't have to rely on what they do because you need their money, but if you can listen to them and then make sense of it for yourself and decide for yourself what's best for the company, I think that's very important. So that's a very important lesson that we learned.
It's better to not have to have that. Well, she's sitting here saying you should work with us. So, Alice, what makes brick and mortar a great investment partner?
Oh, I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's good to have tough conversations with your investor. It's just good if you don't have to do what they say.
I hear you.
I agree. Well, I think the big theme is. Not every company is fit to take venture capital. And this was something that we talked about in my session yesterday, was there are a lot of funding opportunities out there. And depending on what type of business you're trying to build, you may not need venture capital or you should not raise venture capital, depending on, you know, markets, timing, what you're building, what's your go-to-market, what's your pricing strategy, do your customers love you? Maybe you just need that startup capital, right? There's a lot of hardware solutions that you really can't get started without raising venture dollars because it's risky. And, you know, how are you going to build a robot if you don't have money, right? So it's different businesses require different types of funding. Venture capital is one option. And you asked the question about what makes us a different partner. And I would say we're pretty different from other VCs in the sense that our team is not, We don't come from investment banking. We are not hardcore finance people. We actually come from industry. So Nick, when he did the introduction, I am a recovering contractor. I used to work for DPR Construction. I've lived through a lot of the pain points that we are now trying to invest in. My other team members also have some type of relationship with AEC, whether it's growing up around family business or having worked at Kiewit Construction, civil engineering, structural engineering. So we're really from industry, and I think that gives us a lens to work closer with a lot of our portfolio companies. We don't just write a check and say, here's money, go make us a shit ton of money, right? We're not just making money. We are trying to add value to the companies that we invest in by leveraging our networks, making introductions and connections with people who can be potential customers or can help with telling the story, or even just sharing ideas, right? There's a lot of folks from industry that we know that are looking for new technologies to work with. And even if we don't invest in these startups, we're happy to make those connections because at the end of the day, when I look at my team, we just want to move the industry forward. And I think it's really cheesy to say, but that's why I joined Brick and Mortar. I saw it as an opportunity to invest in the technologies that are going to make us more efficient. And we have the labor shortage, we have all these issues. And it was kind of a way for me that, you know, helps me sleep at night by being that greedy VC. But I do try to justify that, hey, I'm trying to help make the industry more productive.
And I would say you totally are. And one of the things I wanted to just take a moment and talk about is Alice has made some really good introductions that have become a bunch of podcasts that we've done recently with investments that Brick and Mortar has made. And why I did the podcast is because it was very relatable, hopefully, to the people that are listening. And when she makes those introductions, she's talking about the Roomba of construction. And you're like going to this, that's intriguing, of the vacuum with rugged robotics. And you have these conversations about sometimes you have to get somebody that's not totally in the mess to kind of help you get to the next level. And that's what Alice and the team that I've really seen them do. Moritz, I'm curious, now that you've sold Enscape, what weren't you prepared for after now that you've sold it?
Yeah, that's tricky. But yeah, so I think what you think is easier once you think you're happy, you're free, and then you're not too old. So what do you do next? That's the tricky bit. It's if you have had a somewhat decent success, it's kind of hard to find something because you also want to grow that where you think it's more successful. So finding the next big thing that will outgrow what you have done before is actually not as easy as I would have thought. this is really, maybe it's a period now, maybe looking back 10 years from now, I would say this is, I overstated, overestimated, but in the moment, it's really a tough challenge. So what to do next with my life now that this chapter is over?
And that's fascinating, right? We're all saying, like, well, you now have time, right? And two things we don't have enough of is time and money. So you have time. So, like, some of us that are hustling at startups that don't have a lot of time, well, like, what's the best business book you read recently to help us that maybe you've had a little bit more time to give us some insight on that?
Actually, it goes into this direction. It's the business book is called Build by Tony Farrell, I think is his name, who built he was at Apple, created the iPod, built Nest as a company. And so he describes pretty much this process where he said it took him 10 years to from the idea to have Nest to actually start the company. So take your time is one of his advices. So I thought this resonated well with me. And also his way of how you do it, how you start with the idea and then how you iterate through the ideas, write a press release, do mock-ups and all that. So this really helps on the way of doing that, finding this next thing. Yeah, so this is a very good book. I can really recommend it. I think it's also on a bestseller list right now, so easy to find for everyone.
Awesome. But I have a question. Would you ever work for anyone else in between starting another thing?
I think I'm not really employable.
You just learned too many bad habits working for yourself. I'm just kidding.
You know, we were very happy that we were a founding team of two, and we had some tough discussions, even on the same level. And I think it is even harder if you work for someone if you're not used to not agreeing and then. Culture-wise, I'm not sure I'm made for that.
Yeah.
I think this is something, some quality that, and something that I have achieved now that I don't have to do that, and I don't think, I would enjoy it.
So the keynote, who was at Greg Leung's Connect Homes keynote? So if you didn't get that one or another perspective, we just released a podcast where Greg and I had several conversations that the podcast was kind of a mini prep for what he did in his keynote. And that was an introduction, the podcast. Again, thanks. We're not related, but even after that, it's funny how when you have all these conversations, I just assumed all the way till it got to the end. But I really appreciated how Greg decided to really talk about the ups and downs and the roller coaster of being at the beginning of Apple to now Connect Homes, but in the middle, things that was the best and brightest, like that video he showed how awesome that lock was, just wasn't time, right? And I think it's important that we take time to think, like, not everything's going to work, even if it's the best idea. And that's what Phil and I talk a lot about, of leaving what we're doing once in a while to then move forward. So Moritz, on the book thing, as a lifelong learner, what's the best non-business book that you've read in the last 5 years or so?
To be honest, I haven't read all that many non-business books. I read many business books, but not too many non-business books. But I have read, I'm from Germany, so I have read Alexander von Humboldt. Maybe you know there's Humboldt Stream and Humboldt Penguin and so on. So he was an adventurer a couple of hundred years ago. And I think it was even his 300th anniversary or something last year or 2 years ago. And I found that very inspiring because in a time when people were kind of staying close to where they were, he did a lot of exploration and found out many things. And so that was very inspiring how he traveled the world and adventured and shaped the way we look at nature now in the different climate zones. And so he found that out. So that was very inspiring. And yeah. Generally, I like reading the biographies because you can always learn a lot from what other people have gone through. And because typically when you write a book about a subject, you always write what's worked well, and you don't necessarily write what didn't work. But in a biography, you always also tell the lows. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I like that, and that's why I also like this book. And yeah, his name was Alexander, and my first son is called Alexander, so maybe that's why. Because actually, his birthday is on the same birthday as my first kid. So yeah, it was maybe an influential book still.
Yeah, and these questions were all put together by Phil, and I think Phil is a great leader of making us pause and think about. I wouldn't have asked that question, because it's always about business for me. So it's people to help you think about that, and that's what I really wanted to put out there to the group. Phil, you and I talked at the pre-thing about just kind of, can you talk about from your perception along those lines with guidelines for investing?
Oh, okay. So guidelines, my guidelines for investing, I think if you're going to invest yourself, and it's not like you have to have a pot of money to invest. It's just, I think you have to think about it in terms of, well, first you have to decide, well, let me go back one more. I don't want to be a contrarian, but I have the tendency. So I think you have to believe in the concept of ethical wealth, that wealth can be created in non-parasitic ways, that wealth is good. And wealth doesn't mean a lot of money and becoming a miserly, bitter person. Wealth means you have the opportunity to remain curious. You have the opportunity to help others. You have the opportunity to say no to things that are uninteresting to you. Because if you have a life that is incurious and you can't say no, and you're struggling, money to me is just the representation of time and energy. So money is just energy. It's the energy to direct things. So if you don't believe in this concept of ethical wealth, that wealth can be created in non-parasitic moral ways, you can use wealth to do good things, then it's hard to even conceive of how would you become, financially more independent. I use the example of, why would you not watch TV? How much do you guys get paid an hour? You know what it is. You run the number in your head. Would you pay that much an hour to watch TV? If you wouldn't, then don't watch TV. Now, I would pay a lot of money to watch South Park. So that is one of my TV exceptions. I will watch South Park. Or I'll watch, Jasper loves Star Wars. He loves the whole Star Wars universe. I will sit down with Jasper and watch The Mandalorian. I don't know if I really care that much about the Star Wars universe, but we're connecting. That's an investment. I'm spending that time. So not watching TV. The idea of making poor health decisions. Everything is on the internet at the time where college is unrecoverably expensive. Okay, this is a terrific irony. I think college has moved from becoming the thing that we use to become adults to becoming a status indicator. We're getting that expensive piece of paper because people want to know where you went to college, who are your parents, that sort of thing. So it's from poor health decisions, staying curious, means what are you going to do with your, what should you do with your time as an investment? Because that's really what you're investing, your time and money. I would really encourage you guys, especially during the pandemic, number one, to become generalists, to stay curious, to don't just become an expert at one thing. I think I would argue that during the pandemic, we made a lot of bad decisions because experts who are really good at one thing got to make the decisions. They were not good generalists, and they said we should shut these down, we should close these things, and we should keep the liquor stores open, but close the gyms and don't let people go outside in the air and walk around. Like, to me, that never made sense. So become a generalist, become pretty good at a lot of things as opposed to just really smart at one thing. This means, like for me during the last probably 10 years or so, learn to cook well. You can learn to cook anything on YouTube and you will learn to cook it well, but it's not just the cooking well part. It's the ritual of having friends around. It's the ritual of choosing the right wine. It's the ritual of preparing meal with people and sitting down and enjoying it. Now, what's the alternative? I would say it would be hard to spend more than $100 on an amazing meal with friends. But you can go to a restaurant, be rushed in and out. They're practically vacuuming under your feet while you're eating. Oh, no, you're fine. You can stay as long as you want. And they're cleaning up underneath you. And then you're going to get out for $100 a person. The moment that it becomes bittersweet, that you go to a fine restaurant, you go, wow, I could have done better myself. right? So learn to cook well. Now you become curious, you become interesting. You're going to start to meet people. You're going to start to entertain clients. And instead of just going, oh, let's go to this restaurant and be rushed out, even if you go to a nice restaurant around here, I had a nice meal at Ruth's Chris the other night. I could have done better than that. You have people over the house. You relax. You're there for a couple of hours. You learn things. You build rapport. You build relationships. And then that's kind of what I think it starts to get interesting. So you don't spend time that you wouldn't literally spend watching TV. You don't make poor health decisions by eating processed food. You eat food made out of food. And then why don't you buy $4 coffees? Okay, so here's the thing. A coffee doesn't cost $4. How much was the first iPod? It was $400 in 2001, October 2001. Except it didn't cost $400. It cost you $150,000. Anybody that bought an iPod, you had a choice. You could put that $150, $400 in Apple stock, or you could buy a $400 iPod, which now you probably can't find. If you didn't throw it out, it's under a drawer somewhere. So money is not just the cost of a thing, and that goes with studying architecture as a college student. It's not just the cost of doing it, it's the opportunity cost of not doing something else. So I would argue that you could probably work at Starbucks for 5 years instead of going to architecture school. And after 5 years of living at home, you'd have $150,000 and be debt free. And you could decide whether or not to go to architecture school at that point. Like, what else could you do with that? So the iPod didn't cost $400. It cost $150,000 because that was the opportunity cost that you missed out on. So the reason I don't buy $4 coffees is because, well, what else could I do with that? Or could I make my own coffee? So every time you spend money, it's not just what you spend, it's also what you didn't spend it on that could have grown into something else, and then that turns into opportunities later. I think staying curious is important. Learning to play an instrument is important. Spending time with friends and getting offline is important. Turn off the TV is important. Well, I suppose I could stop there. I could talk a little bit about why I've invested in certain companies, but I think the reason they were successful, I didn't learn until after the fact. So I could talk about that later. I could just bloviate for a few more minutes, I suppose.
Yeah, also, if everyone would have known that Apple would have developed that way, I guess no one would have invested that way. Hindsight is 2020.
But I think there are vectors. You don't know exactly where the hurricane is going to hit, but you can go, it's probably going to be the East Coast of the US. So I invest in tools where the sum of the parts where it's an ecosystem that the effect of those tools is a sum greater than the individual parts. Okay, so the iPhone might not have the best camera. The Autodesk may not have the best BIM tool. I mean, those are religious discussions, right? Is it ARCHICAD or is it Revit, that sort of thing. But what the companies that I look back after reading a book by Scott Adams called Win Bigly, he talks about creating talent stacks, which is really good for you guys. Learn how to do a lot of things pretty good. It's more effective than learning to do a few things really, really well. So ecosystems have this interesting thing that's happened. It creates something called a natural monopoly. Autodesk may not have the best BIM tool, but they also have a tool that allows you to host it. And they also have a tool that allows you to edit the video once you've created it. And they also have a tool that does. So another company comes along and Alice says, oh, that's great. You've made a BIM tool. You've made the Revit killer. How are you going to sell it? How are you going to market it? Where are you going to host it? What are you going to call it? How are you going to, right? And now you go, oh, well, it's not about the tool. It's not about the technology. It's about the ecosystem. So as I've looked back in this concept of talent stacks, I've realized that accidentally, the companies that I've invested in are natural talent stacks. They're natural monopolies. So Autodesk may not have the best BIM tool, but they have an amazing ecosystem. Apple may not have the best phone, but they have an amazing ecosystem. If you drop or smash your phone tonight, you go to the store, you buy a phone, you pick it up, you turn it on, you back up from your iCloud, right? So they've created a really interesting ecosystem around wearables, around the phone, around computing. And I think Google has done that as well. NVIDIA has an extraordinary ecosystem of developers that's not just NVIDIA for graphic cards, it's facial recognition, it's processing of, I mean, they're doing extraordinary work, but they have an enormous ecosystem of developers. NVIDIA, Apple, Google, Adobe is a natural ecosystem. Photoshop's really expensive, but they have this ecosystem that you also have to purchase every year. Same with Autodesk. So finding these natural ecosystems, I think, is really compelling, because when the next Revit killer comes along and they go to a big architecture firm and say, oh, you should buy our Revit killer because we have a better thing than Revit, they'll go, yeah, but where are we going to host it? What are we going to call it? So those are the kinds of things that I would look at from an investment standpoint, because ultimately, it's hard for customers to get away from those natural monopolies, those natural ecosystems, especially if you have a good customer experience. And that's one of the other things, to Alice's point, of the no asshole rule. You guys go into Apple Store and feel hassled out. You feel rude. If you go to a coffee store and you do get a $4 coffee, the moment they don't say thanks or have a good day, you can get coffee anywhere. So you're always, I think as humans, we're always looking for a polite human experience. We're looking for a polite connection. Thank you as a coffee gets passed is important. As an Apple customer, you feel that you're treated kindly, you're treated fairly. The moment you find out that you're not having a polite customer experience, then you vote with your dollars elsewhere. So the moment Apple starts treating its customers poorly, or Autodesk does, to the point where there's a critical mass, I'll take my money out and find out the company that treats people well. So those are kind of my rules for, you know, looking for and investing in natural ecosystems. And where I think it's worked out is something like the iPod. The iPod itself was a thing that's now obsolete, but it helped to fund and create a natural ecosystem. Whereas if you had $400 in Apple stock when the iPod was released, it would be worth about $150,000 now.
And relating that to construction, as we're going to get to the last two questions, and then I want to pass this mic around, because it's about awareness and community that I think, and I look at the who's in the audience here, a lot of fans that have supported the Art of Construction from the beginning, right? And looking at these ecosystems and putting them together. So the last two questions, and then think about passing the mic, because I'm going to challenge us all in this room to say, people like Ben Glunz in the back, one of our top rated podcasts, let's make this one of those that just pushes it out there. Because I raise my hand and say, I've never used Revit, but I love the origin story, right? And the origin story of kind of this conference and this community is around this Revit that became this Autodesk that we've all learned to just say, that's kind of the best platform and community and ecosystem to all work together in and help each other to make that work. And I use, in my business, I always call it family, and then I changed it to the team. And because you can pick your team, but you can't pick your family. And so think about that as we close this out with a couple of last questions, and then we're going to pass the mic around for the audience. That then we're going to do a big selfie and put it on social media, and we'll all tag it and keep this thing moving as the AOC tribe. So, Alice, last question. What present AEC technology is more hype than reality?
Oh, my God. There's too many. I mean, if you were at Kelly Cohn's NFTs, metaverse, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I think the most recent one that still kills me every time is digital twin. And it's like...
There are more twins popping up in this conference everywhere.
Yeah, and it's like everyone is doing digital twin. Every marketing thing that I see, every startup pitch still has to have some digital twin connection, and it's like...
But is it still worse than NFT?
Well, AEC.
So we did a podcast with Kelly. That is his... I was a big fan of David Letterman growing up, of his top 10 list. So I took his presentation and had him tell me the top 10. So there's a podcast coming out that he is very good at having fun with all this different stuff. Moritz, what is the worst business advice you've ever received?
At least the most impactful is selling the company, I would guess. And whether it's the best or the worst, time will tell. one investor of ours always told me that, you know, he knows a lot of people who are rich now and who sold too early. So looking back now, the way that Enscape developed, maybe we have sold too early, maybe we haven't. Only time will tell. Also, what I can come up with, what we're gonna do, how things will develop. In the moment, I think it was a good advice, and I think everyone who gives you an advice tries to give you a good advice from his perspective. Whether it turns out to be bad or not, only time will tell. But I think so far I haven't met many people who are ill-meaning and giving you advice where they know it's bad advice. But yeah, I think this is the one.
All right,
15 minutes left.
15 minutes. And so this is going to be on the podcast. That's why we're passing the mic around. Who questions, comments? Hopefully we can, who wants to be first, or I'm going to call somebody out. All right. I was going to call you out anyway. So
I just wanted to say, you know, Moritz, to your comment about the client, and then, you know, your comments about community. I think for us, for Enscape, it was about the community that you created, listening to the clients. So we were there from the beginning, and we could call you guys up at any moment, and you would literally answer our call. And we would say, oh, hey, we're using it, but we want it to do this, or we want it to do that. And then it would do it. And that got us more excited, and that got us wanting to talk about Enscape and wanting to use it more. And I think that that business model was really successful.
Yeah. Thank you. So no question, just compliments. That's also nice.
My takeaway, it sounds like the TF Academy should start a cooking class. Who else? Someone has a question about a guy that just built and sold a company.
How do you combat FOMO on missing out on the next big thing, or having an eye to the next big thing?
How do you miss out?
I always am battling internally with, am I keeping up with what's coming, leading edge versus cutting edge? So how do you balance yourself? I know, Phil, you talk philosophy a lot about how to like disconnect, but how do you balance that fear of missing out on the next wave of technology that's coming?
I would say investing based on facts and not emotions. And this is, you know, even from our investment committee, right? Sometimes you get out of this meeting and it's like, holy shit, that's the next thing, right? Because it's like, they can tell a great story. It sounds like a great product. They're selling a dream. But then when you go back and wait on it a little bit, right? Take a couple of days, you think it through and it's like, oh, well, there's actually three other competitors and maybe they should actually be selling to the architect instead of the engineer first. Or, you know, then you start thinking about all of these things. And I think it's just taking that extra time to is that the right investment? And the thing is, on the investing side, right, even if you're doing early stage angel investing or whatever, there are people and internet articles that tell startup founders to drive FOMO because they want people to get in all at the same time. And they want you to get in without doing diligence, right? So for us, it's like, you know, we're kind of fortunate in the sense that we can leverage our industry connections for diligence. We have kind of our own internal gut feels about diligence. And just doing that diligence and making sure that, you know, keeping yourselves accountable. Why did I make that investment? Because XYZ. That's really important.
Brandon, I'll say that the thing you have to have time for, and all you guys have to make time for quiet. Because otherwise you're just being pulled and distracted by everybody's trying to sell you something. And if they're not, what's that line from The Princess Bride? Life is pain, and if you think people aren't trying to sell you something, they're wrong or something. It's a great movie. Anyway, so you have to find time for quiet. You really have to find time. You have to wait for the stillness. You have to get past wanting to look at your phone and just sit quietly and have time to think about it. And it's a hard thing to do, but once you get into that mode, you'll find that it's essential to making good decisions. The rushed decision, the angrily spoken word, all of that, it doesn't turn out well. So you have to just go, hey, that's a great idea. Let me think about it. If they're rushing you to buy, you have to buy now, there's something else wrong. There's something not right. You're not going to miss out. If it's going to work, it's going to work. If it doesn't, it's not. But don't be rushed into something that may not be a good business fit. Because that's the thing about the power of saying no. If you say no, it's not about saying no all the time. It's about freeing yourself up for the opportunity to say yes when it presents itself. And those moments don't come along frequently. And if you've said yes to everything, Now you're being dragged in 10 directions and you can't make the good decision when it arrives. Turn off the music, turn off the TV. Yeah, get into a quiet space. It's hard to do because the screen's right there all the time that wants to tell you what you should be afraid of.
Hey, Phil. So back to you.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
How do licensed architects react to your take on, you know, getting into the profession?
First half of that is I don't care. The second part of that is
about the general take. They might completely agree with you.
No, well, the first part is I don't care. The second part is I really care. And the thing is, sending kids to school for 5 years and then they get out and find out they don't know how to solve problems because they're institutional arrogance at universities that go, oh, we don't really teach them these tools. We teach them to think. I can't pay anyone to think. I can only pay someone to solve a problem. And in many cases, we find that the students that come out of high school and go to technical school are so much, they're ready to show up and be diligent. Whereas the students come out of five-year universities, there's an arrogance there that, well, I have to make this much money. I'm like, well, how did you come to that conclusion? Well, I borrowed this much money to go to school. I'm like, wow, you're in harm's way. So yeah, I think those of us who've been in the profession a long time and understand the grind of architecture also understand that being economically vulnerable is horrible. And so we should mentor students to be in positions where they're not economically vulnerable. So we should teach them Excel in the first year of architecture school. We should teach them to use the tools that help us make design decisions to make better buildings. It's not pejorative to learn how to use these tools. I've had professors and deans tell me we don't teach our students to use software. We teach them to make to think. And I'm like, yeah, that's great. I don't know.
Thanks a lot for the discussion. It's been great. Maybe this is directed at Alice, but yesterday you talked about accelerator programs. If you have an idea, what's for a new startup? What should they be really focusing on as as a business plan or pitch deck or something else? Because they're time poor. What should you really focus on at that stage?
Testing it out. Is there a free way for you to get market feedback, market research, whatever it is? I've seen some great entrepreneurs just build some hokey thing in Google Sheets and was able to sell it as a product to test out with customers. So if there's any way for you to do market research for free with building a little bit of something, there's just so many free or very inexpensive tools out there today. There's a lot of no-code solutions where you can build apps, you can build workflows, you can build all this stuff to really just do that initial market test. And then once you're able to prove out that this is actually a big problem that a lot of people are willing to pay for, then I think that's the point where you start thinking about, okay, should I actually raise money to do this? Or could I invest $5,000 to have someone on Fiverr build out a little bit of something and you could bootstrap it a really long way? You could even, like Enscape, go a really long ways being really lean and building a great product that people love. And maybe you don't need to raise venture dollars, right? So I think there's a lot that people can do nowadays, especially, right? You can create websites with Squarespace. You can do all these no-code solutions. There's just so many free or very inexpensive ways to build stuff.
Agreed. And that doesn't help you if you go to an accelerator or not. So getting customer feedback does help. And I think that's also something that historically we've done wrong. We've spent so much time writing and iterating the pitch deck and the business plan, because then you go through these business plan contests and you go there, you win, you feel very good. But then if you don't get a customer, and we had this done with our first startup, and we struggled because we created something that where we thought it was very great, but then it turned out that no one wanted it.
There's a lot of these.
Which is the first podcast.
And you can avoid that by talking to the customer early on and showing them something, some mock-up or whatever, and very inexpensively without writing a pitch deck or a business plan. There's always value in that. we also learned a lot. You learn a lot about if you research the market, if you research the customer, if you research how you go to market. You can also learn a lot about that, but also you can do that after what Alice just described.
And what you read online is not reflective of the truth, right? You look at all these McKinsey reports that have been talking about everyone is doing prefab modular for the last, I don't know, 10 years. When you look at reality, who is actually doing prefab modular, right? Every single company on LinkedIn is doing prefab modular. But if you look at the entire construction market, what percentage of that is actually prefab modular, right? So I think this is where, you know, you can do a little bit of market research online here and there. You can find reports. You can do all this stuff. But really talking to the customers and you know, talking to people who are boots on the ground and people who are actually doing the real work, that's where you actually get those insights, the feedback, and that's what's going to shape the best product that you're going to build.
Awesome. So our last question is, my father-in-law, who's one of my advisors, and he's like, Devin, you do a good job of getting into the passing lane, but don't stay there or you're going to get smashed, right? And so the last question we're going to end with is, Bill allowed us to give out some passes and people that, so one of the winners that got a free pass here raised his hand, and I'm proud of him for being here and asking the last question. So that's my last thing I'd say is, you don't know unless you ask, right? So kudos for you for asking, signing up. And here's the last question, Jordan.
Thanks, Devin, for the tickets and built. Jordan from Kaya Prefab. I think we're going to start to see a lot of generalists. And as all three of you have said, the next disruptions in construction, they're going to be small teams. They're going to come from maybe the architects that are just a little burnt out, but they've seen buildings get built, new assemblies be used, and all the tech solutions that have come up, and they're easy to use. Doesn't take a full team of 50 designers or contractors to build something that works. And the tools are in the hands of individuals now, and we're going to start to see small teams really disrupt the big guys. And the modular and prefab industry that exists today, they might be thrown to the trash. We're going to see new wall assemblies. We're going to see new materials from industrial designers, people that go to textile events and material sciences. They're going to start to look at other industries and put the pieces together. They're going to really see what the true problems are and change the landscape. I don't think what the AEC industry is today is going to be what it is maybe 5-10 years from now.
And there you have it. So Phil, you started this whole thing, closed us out, and thanks for putting us all together and being part of this whole deal.
Yeah, man. What am I supposed to say? Something now? Thank you very much. I'm glad we could do this.
Yeah, thank you all. It's been a pleasure.